This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our listeners who support us at patreon.com and by Verso Books, which has loads of great left-wing titles, perfect for Dig listeners like you. One that you might like is the 2019 Verso Radical Diary and Weekly Planner, a stylish diary filled with radical historical dates from across the world. The 2019 Verso Radical Diary is a beautifully designed week-to-view planner where you can keep track of the year ahead. Alongside illustrations and book excerpts, it features significant radical dates from throughout history, including the English Civil War and Black Panther movement, through to the protests of 1968 and feminist emancipation, touching on the lives of revolutionaries such as Angela Davis, Rosa Luxemburg, and Martin Luther King Jr. The 2019 edition includes illustrations from Savage Messiah, Laura Oldfield Ford's brilliant psychogeographic graphic novel, as well as extracts from brand new Verso books, including Revolting Prostitutes, New Dark Age, and Paradise Rot. The 2019 Verso Radical Diary and Weekly Planner, out now from none other than Verso Books. Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. Historian Howard Zinn died in 2010. Today, he remains a model for left-wing intellectuals. In How to Convey Ideas to a Broader Public Beyond Academia, and also in terms of taking direct action to transform the world that it is an intellectual's profession to explain. Teaching at Spelman, a black liberal arts college for women in Atlanta, Zinn supported and advised the sit-in movement. During the war on Vietnam, he traveled to Hanoi with radical Catholic priest Daniel Berrigan to receive American prisoners whom the North Vietnamese had shot out of the sky. And, of course, he published A People's History of the United States, a book that, likely more than any other, has prompted young readers to, for the very first time, see the foundational myths that we are weaned on in the United States of American innocence and meritocratic reward as lies. Lies that not only obscure atrocities from Native genocide onward, but also, critically, the fact that ordinary people have organized in opposition at every turn. As Eric Foner wrote in an obituary published at The Nation, few historians manage to reach a broad non-academic audience. Those who do generally write monumental history, works that celebrate great men or heroic events. Zinn's history was different. Through A People's History and various spin-offs, Zinn's public learned about ordinary American struggles for justice, equality, and power. Foner writes, "I have long been struck by how many excellent students of history first had their passion for the past sparked by reading Howard Zinn. Sometimes, to be sure, his account tended toward the Manichaean, an oversimplified narrative of the battle between the forces of light and darkness. But A People's History taught an inspiring and salutary lesson that, despite all too frequent repression, if America has a history to celebrate, it lies in the social movements that have made this a better country." As for past heroes, Zinn insisted one should look not to presidents or captains of industry, but to radicals such as Frederick Douglass, Susan B. Anthony, and Eugene V. Debs. It's with all that in mind that my guest today, Kianga Yamada Taylor, one of the most important public intellectuals of today's resurgent socialist left, has written a foreword to a new edition of You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, Zinn's autobiography. Before we move on, this, of course, is the portion of my introduction when I charm you into supporting this left-wing podcast that you listen to. And that's because this show can quite literally only exist because you, the listeners, support us at patreon.com/thedig. We need your support to ensure that The Dig is a sustainable venture over the long haul. And by sustainable, in part what I mean is that the less I have to worry about fundraising, the more I can focus on podcasting. We are also planning to get Dig interviews transcribed for a new website. And that costs money too. There's also more in it for you. $5 a month gets you access to our newsletter, which has tips on how to learn more about the topics we discuss on the show. $10 gets you either a copy of Jacobin's ABCs of Socialism or Assad Hader's Mistaken Identity. $20 or more, and you get a bunch of left-wing books mailed to you. So, if you're a regular listener who hasn't yet contributed, please do so now at patreon.com/thedig. It'll only take a few minutes. Okay, here's Kianga Yamada Taylor, a professor of African American Studies at Princeton and the author of From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation and How We Get Free, Black Feminism and the Combahee River Collective, both from Haymarket Books. The new edition of You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train is out now from Beacon. Kianga Yamada Taylor, welcome back to The Dig.
Hi, Dan. Very glad to be here.
You write, quote, "The power of Howard Zinn, the writer, has overshadowed his fascinating history as an active participant in these powerful social movements." What actions and moments most stuck out to you about the various roles that Zinn played across so many eras of the American left?
Probably the two, you know, most interesting and perhaps most formative for him was the role he played in the civil rights movement and then his role in the anti-war movement, the movement against the war in Vietnam, you know, which stemmed from his service as an Air Force bomber pilot in World War II. His level of involvement in the civil rights movement, I think, would probably be surprising to people, you know, because people are most, especially, you know, the further you get away from that period, the familiarity with Zinn stems mostly from his book, The A People's History. But that whole framework of a people's history, which is to look at history from below, really comes from his involvement as an active participant. And so what that meant in the civil rights movement was that, you know, he was part of the on-the-ground daily grind of the Southern movement that often gets eclipsed in our celebrations of Martin Luther King, our celebrations of the big march.
Like the spectacular confrontations.
Yeah. And so there, you know, Howard Zinn is involved in many unspectacular confrontations, but you can see through his writing, which is very deliberate, the movement is really held together by the actions of ordinary activists, but also people across the South who had everything to lose, including life itself, but who learned and weathered the ups and downs of what any social movement produces to really transform themselves and transform the South. The South, after a period of time, could no longer continue to go in the way that it had been going because Black people refused to be ruled in that way. And so he charts in a very granular way the process by which people go from being afraid to becoming aware that they are really the only people who are in a position to change their circumstance. And that can come with great sacrifice, but it can also come with great heroism and also important lessons for those of us who deal with this question about social movements, how they work, and what makes them effective.
Though Zinn's histories definitely did overshadow his personal history, as you write, his writing and his life were also sort of similar echoes of each other in the sense that in his life, he modeled the very sort of lives of committed struggles that he held up in his books. And as you mentioned, of course, his most famous is a people's history. Why do you think that has become one of the most popular American history books ever?
There's something about getting a more complicated view of history that puts regular people at the center of it, that not only makes for a more interesting rendition of history, but it demystifies the perennial question that all of us who care about the condition of the world have, which is how can this change? What has to happen in order for things to be different, or even if they can be? And I think that Zen both takes the mystery out of that and debunks the kind of central mythologies of American history, that history is sort of moved along or motored by the actions of white men and, you know, the governing institutions of our great democracy. You know, it's not enough just to say that, well, that's not true and history is more complicated, but, you know, he literally turns the story upside down and puts millions of ordinary people who are often lost to history, who are rendered invisible in history, and brings them into the center to say that, you know, change is complicated and it's hard, but through the collective intelligence and abilities of regular people, it can actually happen. And it's not miraculous and it's not magic, but that it is, you know, it's these small struggles that can turn into larger struggles, that fail, that, you know, take us backwards sometimes. But then the conditions that put so much pressure in people's lives compel them to go forward. Then you hear about the role of radicals and politicos who bring themselves together in organizations to try to learn from the lessons of the past, who try to learn from history as a way to shape their strategies and tactics for, you know, contemporary social movements. And so in that way, it's very dynamic and alive and makes more sense to people, I think, than the typical histories, which are told from the top down and, you know, are shrouded in mystery, that he cuts through a lot of that to get to the heart of matters, which I think is more profound for people.
You write that he not only makes ordinary people the protagonists of his histories, but also makes more ordinary events more central to the plot. And you say that he reads the impact of political actions in an unconventional way. For example, the way that he looks at the civil rights movement's, quote, failure in Albany, Georgia in 1961 and 62, and the disappointingly small anti-Vietnam War protests in 1965. Tell me about the way he viewed these sort of out of the way or seemingly failed moments in left mobilization.
Well, I think the first thing is, for me at least, is understanding why that is an important observation, because a lot of people who are unfamiliar with organizing through no fault of their own, you know, have little idea of that it's often the kind of failed attempts that lead to the bigger successes, meaning that big successful marches that are connected to social movements, especially in this period of the 1960s, don't come from heaven, that they have to be built and organized. And sometimes that lesson today can be distorted because you can have, you know, lots of money from foundations that, you know, swoop in and, you know, make all of these resources available. But then you still have the same problem if it's not connected to ongoing organization or organizing, then, you know, it's a little bit of a flash in the pan that can bring attention to a particular issue, but doesn't create the means to actually do anything about it. And so I think that there are two things at work in what Zen is trying to do. One is trying to really distill the way that consciousness develops. And so in the Albany, Georgia example, you know, this is perennially held up as one of the failures of the civil rights movement because it didn't create the kind of clash, the spectacle that King relied on to bring the news media in, to gather the attention of the federal government as a way to create pressure to get federal officials to force Southern officials to comply with federal law. And so this didn't happen in Albany, Georgia, because the police sheriff in that town just put people in jail without having a huge confrontation around it. They just put hundreds of people in jail, you know, which of course might warrant attention, except that the sheriff in Albany, Georgia was lauded for not beating local people and activists. And so because of this, it's seen as an unsuccessful campaign in comparison to Selma or in comparison to Birmingham or other well-known victories within the movement. But Zen, as a participant in the Albany campaign, had a different viewpoint, which is that he recognized how the efforts of local people to involve themselves in movement activities that involved essentially overcoming an enormous, at times crippling fear of the political, legal, economic establishment in that town meant that even though in these particular campaigns that, you know, there was not a, quote, victorious outcome, the victory was in the transformation of local people because they had overcome their fear. And once they had overcome their fear, they were halfway there because the political establishment in that town relied, and across the South, relied on fear that had been developed over decades through brutality, through economic terrorism, through physical and violent coercion to maintain the status quo. And so once that fear had been broken and people realized that they could actually play a role in dismantling the status quo locally, that was where the victory lied, not in whether or not there was a big campaign. And so this was an important point that could be generalized, which is why I think that he put it in the book. And so even if it's not just a, you know, a question of racial terrorism and fear that comes out of the specific civil rights example, the bigger question is how do people overcome the reluctance that stems from the idea that we can't change our own circumstance, that either some other entity, whether it's an elected official or something else outside of us, has the power to change things, but that we don't have the power ourselves. What is the process by which that is overcome that is crucial? It's a crucial part of consciousness that is involved in the willingness for people to not just participate in a march here or there, but to really invest themselves in a social movement and a political project aimed at transforming their own conditions. So that's one thing. I think with the Vietnam example, you know, he talks about the frustration of organizing demonstrations early on in the war that get very little traction. So, you know, hundreds of people may show up to a demonstration, but clearly that is not enough to pose any kind of challenge or resistance to the American war machine. And so he walks people through two things. One is that there are things that organizers can do over a period of time that can make for more effective organization. So, you know, there's a process by which people learn how to improve outreach, how to improve getting the word out about a particular action. Over time, relationships can develop that put you in a position to be able to reach wider numbers of people than you may be able to in an initial instance. But there's also social factors at play that have nothing to do with your organizing ability.
And it's voluntarist to believe that organizers can just call mass movements into being. Those are shaped by forces outside of our control.
But this is the utility of this book, right? Is that it's explaining that it's a combination of objective and subjective factors that, you know, can diverge, you know, most frequently, but they can converge as well. And if we are positioned in such a way that, you know, we can sometimes take advantage of that, but many times it has nothing to do with us. And so the acceleration of the Vietnam War is a factor that helps to drive the growth of the anti-war movement. But because you had committed activists who had been involved from the very beginning, they were able to take advantage of that situation to not just, you know, sort of watch the demonstrations get bigger, but someone had to call the demonstrations, even when they were being called names by the federal government. Someone had to be willing to, you know, organize the teach-ins that Zinn participated in. Someone had to be willing to invite him to come. And so you see all of the different elements that go into what creates the conditions for an effective movement, in this case, the anti-war movement. And so I think, you know, Zinn could write an autobiography that is like, you know, 1,000 pages, and it could be compelling and interesting and all of that. But, you know, I found it interesting that, you know, he wrote a relatively modest volume. I mean, I think it's 200 some pages, that he picks these different campaigns, different situations out, because he's not just writing to celebrate himself. He's not writing to celebrate himself at all. He's writing based in his experience what he thinks is useful to a new generation of activists, of people who would be radicalizing, who ask, what do we do? How do we do it? And there's no prescription. There's no, you know, there's no like map to having a successful movement. But there are things that we can learn from history about organizing. There are things that we can learn from history about how consciousness changes. And there are things that we can learn about how, when those things converge, that it does create the conditions for the emergence of a movement of ordinary people that holds the power to transform a situation.
Zinn, I think, was a professor at Spelman, women's HBCU in Atlanta.
Yes.
During the time that he was participating in the Albany campaign. So I want to ask you about how Zinn is really also this model for how to be a left-wing public intellectual engaged with the political world, which incidentally is a role that you've really embraced. How do you think about approaching your role as a public-facing scholar, and what lessons do you take from Zinn's life?
What is an important distinction with some, I mean, you know, people use the framework of public intellectual, and I think that, you know, it's one of these things that means different things to different people. Zinn was an active participant in a social movement, and the movement was surrounding him. I mean, he was teaching at a, you know, Black women's college, a historically Black women's college in the South. And, you know, his students were trying to find ways to be active in this movement that was absolutely would be consequential for the rest of their lives. And so he became an active participant in that, both on his campus and then within the movement at large, so much so that it cost him his job, fired from his job at Spelman. And then when he went to Boston University and began to speak out and actively organize against the war, president of that university tried repeatedly to have Howard Zinn fired.
The infamous John Silber.
Yeah. And so that, you know, that's a level of commitment and sacrifice that, you know, is rarely seen among the kind of class of people we talk about as public intellectuals. You know, that's not a moral pejorative. It's just to say that I think that he might occupy a different kind of space. And so he did use his position as a professor to, he leveraged that position to write reports that were published in the New York Times, that were published in the Nation magazine, which helped to, among other publications, which helped to elevate the political issues at stake in the movement, and to also frame them in such a way that was important when the dominant discourse was that civil rights activists wanted too much too soon. Zinn could use his position to frame these issues differently in ways that highlighted what was at stake in the movement itself. You know, I think that his posture, and yeah, he writes about this in the book, that, you know, he would tell his students that he's not a neutral person, that, you know, all ideas have carry the same significance and weight. And so that,
as the title of his book puts it, you can't be neutral on a moving train.
Comes from that, you know, the world requires, the level of injustice and inequity in the world requires that we take positions. And those positions should absolutely be rooted in fact, in history. And, you know, they're not made up. They should be rooted in something. But that life is really too short to equivocate. You know, we have to take positions on things and then fight for them. And so for me, that's important. It's an ethos that I carry with me into the classroom, which is we can engage in respectful, we have to engage in respectful debates about ideas, but that there's, you know, there are also points of view in history, and it's worth exploring and talking about and understanding. I have certainly seen myself as someone who is trying to figure out with other people, how do we win? What is the most effective way for our side, the oppressed, the working class, Black people, immigrants? How do we win in this struggle for the survival of the planet? And that, you know, when we understand the stakes of things, it's also hard to be talking about neutrality. I mean, we are talking about how do we win for the sake of the survival of the planet and our species. You know, it requires some level of urgency to figure out. And so I write, the projects that I engage with are intended to deal with those questions, to raise the political level around those questions, and to say things that I think are important to consider in the movements that we're building. And so I hope that there is a social movement of weight and significance and of depth and breadth that certainly emerges during my teaching life that I can also be an active participant in as a way to, you know, help introduce students to that, but, you know, also because that it matters and it's consequential to what happens.
The last thing I wanted to ask you about is you cite Zinn to make a point that I've seen you make before after the Women's March, which is that radicals shouldn't be down on ordinary liberal people for their lack of radicalism. And you note that Zinn's own experience getting attacked by police during a demonstration is what radicalized him. Can you say a little about that?
Yeah, I think that that's a crucial lesson to come away with from Zinn. He believed in the potential of everyone to come to radical conclusions, and that, you can't write people off because, you know, everyone comes to those conclusions, those who do, based on a set of personal experiences. I mean, some people, they read Howard Zinn and decide, oh, that makes sense to me. I'm a socialist. There are probably lots of people for whom that happens to. But for every one person that happens with, there are hundreds of more who don't read the book, who try to sort of get through life every day the best that they can. And for those people, radicalization usually happens when there is such a gap between what you were told is possible in this country and what actually takes place. In that gap emerges questions about why is there this disparity between being told that this is the greatest country in the world if you work hard and the fact that many people work hard and don't, quote unquote, succeed. And so you can't write people off. Or in the instance that I was describing is that the vast majority, if not all radicals, begin as liberals, begin with liberal illusions and the ability of the American state and our governing institutions to solve the problems of this country. And so it's only through experiencing that and then seeing those institutions fail over and over again to be able to deliver the change that people who are looking for solutions are in hope of, that then people begin to ask deeper questions about why is this? You know, why are we still fighting to have police not murder Black people? Why is there anticipation or controversy around, you know, Jason Van Dyke in Chicago's trial as to whether or not he killed Laquan McDonald? I mean, we watched it on video. We watched him, you know, shoot this child 16 times, and yet everyone is sitting around in anticipation as to whether or not he will actually be convicted of a crime. And so it's seeing our institutions fail over and over again that opens up the possibility of thinking differently about where change comes from. And so if you just write those people off because they haven't come to the conclusions you have already, then we're not talking about building a mass movement anymore. We're talking about a handful of friends and people who all think the same way, charging into a wall for social change. And that's not going to happen. If we want to actually not just protest this or that bill or this or that action or this or that police killing, all of which can be important, but if we're actually talking about transforming American society into a democratic society, then that requires a mass movement. And a mass movement requires that the consciousness and the ideas of the mass of people transform. And so that, in part, is something that, you know, despite the kind of Trump insanity that we see every day, that deep questioning of the arrangements within U.S. society, I believe, is unfolding before us. I think there are many, we could point to the Ferguson uprising, the Baltimore uprising, the 13 million people who vote for an open socialist Bernie Sanders, the dramatic growth of the Democratic Socialists of America. There are many things that you can point to that show that, in fact, there is a radicalization underway within the United States. And that will grow, and included within that are people who've had liberal illusions in the United States. And those ideas will change as well. But if for those of us who have thought about these things and come to a different set of conclusions, just write those people off as not coming to the right ideas quick enough, then we're never going to actually build and develop the kind of movement that's necessary, not just to tinker with the United States, but to fundamentally change it.
Well, as always, thank you so much, Kianga Yamada-Taylor.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for having me on.
Kanga Yamada Taylor is a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University and the author of From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation and How We Get Free, Black Feminism and the Combahee River Collective, both from Haymarket Books. The new edition of Howard Zinn's autobiography, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, is out now from Beacon. Thank you for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once said, after noting that all mysteries which lead theory to mysticism find their rational solution in human practice and in the comprehension of this practice. While other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We are posting new episodes every week, often but not always twice. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis, music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Our communications coordinator is Logan Dreher. Follow us on Twitter at The Dig Radio, and please find us wherever you get podcasts and subscribe. If it's on iTunes, please leave us a nice review there. Those reviews help introduce us to new listeners. What also does that is you telling your friends or whoever about the show. Please make propaganda for us. And do find us at patreon.com/thedig and make a monthly contribution to keep this thing up and running. Even a few bucks is huge.